Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, and that feeling of dread you feel in the pit of your stomach can only mean that it's time for Il Pio Difettoso di Tutto Podcaste. Joining us this week is Mr. Phil Freeman, author, music critic, and board-certified headbanger, who will help us turn a simple comedy show into an insult to God himself. We'll also feature a new installment of Celebrities Are Our Betters, an important missive from my personal life, and some sweet-ass uptown comedy that will do anything you want for three quarters of an hour. Abandon your children, ignore your job, forsake your country, and lend your full attention to this week's Petardcast. All right, thank you so much once again to Hayden Childs for the show's theme song. Right now we're going to return to Titbits, which was the long-running column I penned for the New York Times until 1989, when I was fired for being a figment of my own imagination. I didn't just use the Titbits column to give advice to men of the 20th century. I also used it to engage in cryptic personal correspondence with various people in my life whose non-cooperation with my agenda would mean jail time or violent retribution for one or the other of us. Here's a little bit that I wrote in the Titbits column in 1978 when I was engaged in what the courts like to call a bitter divorce proceeding with my ex-wife. Darling, I know that you said you didn't want to see me or hear from me, but I think this card complies fully with the court's order of protection, provided I do not hand-deliver it to you. I know it just looks like a cheap 59-cent greeting card manufactured several years ago and purchased from a dusty, underused spin rack at a truck service center in rural Nebraska, but to me, it expresses perfectly my feelings at this, the time of year we are so far apart and should be so close together. See the comical drunk on the cover, leering woozily around a lamppost and sporting disheveled pajamas and an ice bag on his head? That lovable scamp is me, on Thanksgiving night, and on the 7 previous holidays we've spent together, going all the way back to last Halloween, and also every weekend and Thursday and Monday night for the past 2 years. See the nagging wife with her hair up in curlers, stuffed into a shabby floral print dress, wielding a rolling pin like some frightful poleaxe? That's you, only you're much prettier, sweetheart. And see the punchline inside about how I don't have a drinking problem, I just drink, get drunk, fall down, and no problem? That's like our relationship. No problem. Only now I realize there is a problem. A big problem. A problem so important and unique that the spin rack at the Shoemaker's Texaco truck stop in Roca, Nebraska couldn't even help me out of it. A problem called me. Now, it would be easy to place blame. I could, for instance, if I wanted to, blame you for being less attractive than you ideally could have been. Not that you aren't beautiful. Thus driving me into the arms of women who care a little more about taking care of themselves. Or I could blame you for not taking the self-defense classes you talked about when we were dating, because when you think about it, whose fault is it really that you get beaten up? Or I could mention how, since you're a teetotaler, some would say killjoy, but not me, darling, because I love you, you miss out on all the hilarious comments I make when I'm drunk. But I'm not writing you this card with a golf pencil I found in a guy's shoe who hung himself in our cell to play the blame game. I'm writing you to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm so mean to your children, and my children, and our children, and the children that are probably ours, and we've given up trying to find out exactly whose is whose, and besides, a welfare check is a welfare check. Just children in general, I guess. Kids really get on my nerves, but that's no excuse for my behavior. Although you'd think they'd learn to stay away from me by now, especially when I'm drunk. I'm sorry for being so drunk all the time. I can't take all the blame for this one, since it's my body that's betrayed me by letting itself get totally polluted off 6 beers when it used to take as many as 9 just to get a light buzz on. Is it my fault that this has happened? Am I to be punished for maturing? Should I not be allowed to drink just because of one little armed robbery? But the fact is, even though I intend to keep drinking a fifth of rye every 12 hours, that doesn't mean you should have to pay for it. I'm sorry for stealing your diaper money to keep myself in booze. A person who really cared would steal from strangers, not from his loved ones. Tell the kids I'm sorry about their lunch money, too. Maybe soften the blow by mentioning that it was top-shelf rye. I'm sorry for burning your house down. I know what you're saying. There's no need to apologize for that. It was my house, too. But the fact is, I was deliberately trying to burn down just your parts of it because they irritate me so much. It turns out that you can't really selectively burn a house down, and that the flames really took to the collection of old tit magazines soaked in rubbing alcohol that I used in my tool room. But even if that wasn't the case, it was wrong to burn down your parts of the house, especially after you warned me the last 6 times. Darling, I'm saying this because I ran into one of the kids, Mike, Danny, you know, the one with the red hair and the buck teeth, when he was being taken to juvie this morning, and he said that he got busted for trying to hawk some of the Christmas presents. So, sweetheart, love of my life, if there is even a slight chance that there are still presents, and an even slighter chance that some of them are mine, please believe me, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I love you, and if you can throw my bail long enough for me to come home and open my presents, I promise you I will be a changed man. Merry Christmas, baby. Please come home. Home being, at the moment, cell 14 of the municipal lockup. Ask for Randy. They think my name is Randy for the moment. Love forever, Randy. Remember that. All right, it's time once again for Celebrities Are Betters, our semi-annual look at the goings-on of famous people who are better than you and better than me, and that's why we pay so much attention to them. Some of you have written to ask, or should I say complain, that I haven't made it clear exactly how celebrities are better than us. I've just repeated it ad infinitum as if it was the name of a feature I was trying to drive into your heads to generate publicity for this podcast. But I would think that it would be self-evident why celebrities are our betters. The fact that we're writing about them, that should say it all. But in this week's edition, I'll try and make it clear exactly why celebrities are betters with the articles that I have pulled from the various finely written celebrity magazines this week. So let's start out with an article from, this would be from Access Hollywood, one of their rare non-video segments. And it's about Cara DioGuardi, the former American Idol host and songwriter of some sort. She's got a new show coming out, and it's called Platinum Hit. And it's not about people being hit in the face with a piece of platinum, which is too bad. But let's find out what it is about, courtesy of Access Hollywood. Former American Idol judge Cara DiGuardia says that her new music reality show on Bravo, you know it's good, it's on Bravo, will be nothing like her former Fox gig. Platinum Hit is completely different from American Idol or The X Factor because it's about songwriters. Cara told Access Hollywood on Thursday at the 2011 New Now Next Awards in Los Angeles. Did you know that there was a thing called the New Now Next Awards? That's one word, by the way, New Now Next. That's why celebrities are better than you and I, because they not only get to go to the New Now Next Awards, Cara DiGuardi probably won a New Now Next Award for being the newest, nowest, nextiest. And I didn't win any such award. I didn't even know there was such an award. So what more proof do you need? It's not about how they perform the songs. It's about how they write the songs and if they're writing great songs, she continued. It's an inside look at the process of songwriting. You know that's going to be exciting to watch because nothing is more exciting than watching somebody write something. And what it takes to be a hit writer. And if you look at all those shows like the X Factor and American Idol, all those shows, all two of them, without great songs, how would anyone know how anyone sings? That is a great question. Let's contemplate for that for a minute. Without great songs, how would anyone know how anyone sings? I don't even have an answer to that. I'm not even going to continue with this article from Access Hollywood, because until I have solved the enigma of how, without great songs, we would know how anyone sings, life just doesn't even really seem worth living without an answer to that question. So let's move on to People magazine in an article written by Jasmine Hyatt, who is both the heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune and the Jasmine fortune. We learn how Sherry Shepherd is mulling over her honeymoon options. Mulling is something that people do a lot in the press. I've rarely seen somebody mull their options in real life, but it happens a lot in the media. As the date of her August wedding draws closer, 30 Rock star and The View co-host Sherry Shepherd says she is looking forward to married life as well as her wedding cake and honeymoon destination. I've got a really great friend, Shepherd, while she was at Monday's Steve Harvey Foundation Gala. It's no Now New Next Award, but it's something. Told people about husband-to-be Lamar Sally. He keeps me laughing all the time, she says. I think laughter is number one. So there you go. You know, I mean, that's another reason celebrities are better than us, is that they can tell us what's number one. I had previously thought that Iran was number one and the Soviet Union was number one and that the USA was number 20 because I get most of my information from the Iron Sheik. But now I learned from Sherry Shepherd that laughter is number one. He's silly and I'm silly. I think that's a great match. That is a great match. Two people who are silly. Another top priority for Shepherd, a red velvet wedding cake. I love anything red velvet, she says. I think she should wear a red velvet wedding dress. While the type of cake has been decided, what hasn't been is the location for Shepherd and Sally's honeymoon. We've been looking at Thailand or somewhere over in Europe. That's two places, all right, says Shepherd, who likes a beach. Again, this is the prose of journalistic professional Jasmine Hyatt, says Shepherd, who likes a beach. That's why celebrities are better than us, because they like a beach, and in liking a beach, that gets into the news. We want to go somewhere exotic. For the ceremony, Shepherd, 43, has been practicing with her son Jeffrey, who will turn 6 this month, and who will be the one who will escort her down the aisle. Says Shepherd, I'm teaching him how to walk down slowly instead of running, and I'm going to ask him, please don't say, Mommy, I gotta pee. Can you just hold it for 45 minutes? That's a long walk down the aisle, 45 minutes. It seems that Jeffrey has ideas of his own. The other day he said to Sal, I want to be Mommy's husband. I want you to be the son. Mommy, I'm going to get you a ring, Shepard says. There's another reason that celebrities are better than us, is that they can make creepy, incestuous jokes and not be considered insane. So for our last segment, I hope that you who like a beach and those of you who don't like a beach will join us moving on to OK Magazine, my very favorite celebrity magazine. And we're going to read a Gina Oppenheim column or article. Gina, possibly related to the Oppenheim who invented the nuclear bomb. Possibly not. Anyway, she wrote an article for Money, I guess, called Kim Kardashian Multitasks at West Hollywood Nail Salon. This is a great article and perfectly indicative of why celebrities are better than us. It's not easy keeping up with the Kardashians, but sister Kim Kardashian still makes time to primp and pamper herself. I thought that's what they did before they were on TV, was primp and pamper themselves. But anyway, the E-reality star made a pit stop at a West Hollywood nail salon on Friday evening to touch up her manicure. This is the last paragraph of the article. It only has two paragraphs in it. Kim is well aware of how to multitask efficiently as she chatted on her cell phone while picking out a fresh red polish for her nails. So let's have no more of these letters about why celebrities are better than you and I. That answers it right there, because they are capable of talking on the phone and picking out nail polish at the same time. All right, we're back, and we're joined by my friend and MSN heavy metal blogger, amongst other things, Mr. Phil Freeman. How are you, Phil?
Okay.
You want to identify yourself, tell the theoretical audience who you are and what you do?
My name is Phil, and I am an asocial aging dirtbag who writes about metal and jazz and whatever else people will pay me to write about for a variety of outlets. I write for MSN. I write for Alternative Press Magazine, which is awesome because nobody, you know, who's 39 wants to do anything but tell 15-year-olds what's cool.
Right.
And, yeah, it's just, you know, I'm living the sweet life here in suburban New Jersey.
What have you been doing lately to which we should be paying special attention?
Let's see. Well, I have the daily metal blog on MSN.com, which if you go to music.msn.com, you'll see a little logo of the Headbang Heavy Metal blog, which I update Monday through Friday unless I'm not feeling like it. And I update burningambulance.com roughly Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And that's about it. Otherwise, I get on Twitter at PD Freeman and start arguments with people.
All right. You mentioned you lived in suburban Jersey. What do you have to say about that? Is it as portrayed in The Sopranos? Do you shop at Satre Ali's pork store?
It is not. The part of New Jersey that I live in is portrayed more accurately probably just by clicking randomly over to Univision. Most of the stores in my town are run by people from South or Central America. In many cases, the store signs literally have an English subtitle. The main drag of the town is, instead of a double yellow line, it is a red, yellow, and blue line, which is the colors of the Colombian flag.
Nice.
So, yeah, you get the idea. It's. I do not live in a Springsteen song. I live in, you know, like, I live in a novella, basically. And I like that better. The mass media portrayal of New Jersey has never sat well with me. You know, I don't like Bruce Springsteen. I don't want to be part of that life.
Is the New York New Jersey divide as profound as media portrayals would have us believe?
I don't think so anymore. It used to be, but now New York is, you know, Disneyland for billionaires, and so we're all kind of united in our hatred of people from Brooklyn.
All right.
So it's shaken out differently somewhat.
All right. You do a lot of writing about heavy metal. You were my editor back in the glorious Metal Edge days.
Yes.
tell me the best thing about writing about heavy metal and the worst thing about it.
The best thing about writing about heavy metal is just getting paid to listen to metal all day and getting to go into shows for free and, you know, all the dorky stuff that gets people to become music critics of any type in the first place. I get free records in the mail. I get to meet bands, you know, and stuff, and I get to go to shows for free. I get flown to England to sleep on a stinky tour bus for a week, you know. It's that sort of thing. And the worst part of writing about heavy metal is interviewing Joey DeMaio from Manowar.
Why him in particular?
Because he refused to answer my questions, answered the questions he did. The questions he did deign to answer, he answered monosyllabically, and he basically hung up on me after 6 minutes.
Nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. He's a swell guy. And yet I remain a fan.
Do you, as you get older, do you find yourself getting self-conscious about interviewing, like, 18-year-olds?
Only to the degree that when I ask questions that demand a certain amount of cultural context and I get a blank stare in return, that kind of freaks me out a little. You know, when I talk to people who say, when I was in England interviewing the sort of pop punk meets metalcore band A Day to Remember for Alternative Press, the current cover story on newsstands now.
Well done.
I was there for a week hanging out with them, and they were talking about how much fun they had had at a recent festival where they got to meet Gwar, and they got to go on stage and hold flaming torches during Gwar's set, and they thought this was awesome. And I said, wow, I saw Gwar live in 1989, and their drummer was, I think, born in 1991. So, you know, stuff like that can get a little off-putting. But then I spoke to my editor at AP recently, and he's got a decade on me, so... Mm-hmm. We're all good.
Yeah, I had a similar experience when the whole thrash revival thing was happening, and I was hearing, you know, these Southern California Mexican American kids talk about, you know, how hugely influenced they were by these albums that I bought when they were new, and that they bought, you know, when they were 15, and they had been reissued for the third time.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I think rethrash is one of the best things to happen to metal in quite a while.
I've been listening to a lot of like the far European retro thrash stuff, you know, the like Hungarian and Romanian retro thrash bands, and they're so soaked in the good time feel of it, you know, they're so unironically accepting of the whole beer and pussy aspect of it that it's so much fun to listen to. It's like 1983 again, and you know, except is ruling the charts, you know.
I am listening to more and more power metal lately. I think that may be a sign that I'm getting old.
Yeah.
Is that I'm listening to more and more power metal.
Yeah, because... I can't quite cross that line. I try and there's a certain hurdle I just can't put myself over with power metal.
It's funny because I'm kind of nudging that into the world of Burning Ambulance, which, you know, started out as sort of an avant-garde jazz and underground culture sort of thing, where the type of metal we would cover would be I Hate God or Orthodox or, you know, stuff like that. But then one day I ran a review of the most recent album and the EP that immediately preceded it by this Italian power metal band called Rhapsody of Fire. And they actually had Christopher Lee doing narration between songs.
That's right. The
album. And it traffic spiked. So, because it wound up, you know, it wound up getting linked, I think, from Rhapsody of Fire's MySpace page or something. And so all of a sudden, all these power metal kids stumbled on the blog. So, none of them left comments, which disappointed me, but, you know, I knew that they were out there, and that was nice.
Yeah, yeah. What is it about liturgy that inspires so much hatred?
I think it's the guy himself, and it's funny you should ask, because I just interviewed him yesterday. I'm actually writing a story on them for a magazine I shall not name. I'm writing a long feature on that band, and I think it's him. If he was not such a twat, you know, people wouldn't want to slap him so much.
He is prone to some pretty pompous pronouncements.
Yes, he definitely is. But I found him to be a pretty congenial interview subject, and this is one of my big peeves with my fellow, quote-unquote, fellow journalists, is they complain about what douchebags a lot of the musicians they interview are, and it's at least 60 to 75% their fault for asking all the wrong questions. I studied audio engineering. I know how records are made. Most of my peers cannot say the same thing. And so when I get a chance to interview a musician, a lot of the time I will ask them about their actual process of music making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to ask them, hey, how drunk were you when you wrote this song? That's absurd. I'm going to say, how long were you in the studio? You know, do you come in with stuff pre-written, or do you do a lot of pre-production? You know, stuff that actually relates to the physical process of making music. And what happens when you do that is musicians light right up. When you ask them about their job, they want to talk to you.
When you talk to fellow music critics, my experience has been that a lot of them still treat metal like it's a fringe genre, you know, like it's a, you know, we've talked before about how an indie band that sells 2,000 copies will get way more press than a metal band that sells 2 million, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that there's still this shock when you tell people that metal is a much more mainstream kind of music than anything they're used to covering?
Yeah, it's something that they can't conceive of, because I feel like a lot of these people think that the metal bands that Pitchfork covers are the biggest bands in metal, you know?
Yeah, which is absolutely which is, not the case.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, look at, okay, perfect example. Amon Amarth's album came out last week, okay, or maybe 2 weeks ago. Their 2008 album was the one that racked up all these amazing reviews, okay? You know, everybody said, oh, it's their masterpiece, they finally arrived, blah, blah, blah. And the record sold, like, I think 11,500 copies in its first week, which is pretty friggin' awesome, you know, even in 2008. This new one sold 15,000 copies first week. They actually went up in sales in 2011. They're doing better than they were doing 3 years ago. That should be a huge story.
Yep.
They had a top 40 album on Billboard, and they still sound exactly like Amon Amarth, you know? I mean, they sound more like Amon Amarth on this record than they did on the last one, because the last one they had, like, guest stars coming out the woodwork. You know, they had strings, and they had all this stuff. This new one is 10 songs of just total Viking savagery, and there it is in the top 40. You know, it's ridiculous. And yet when you tell people, you know, oh, this band sold twice whatever, you know, Amon Amarth does twice what Fleet Foxes does or whatever, you know, people just kind of go, no, that's impossible.
Yeah, I remember reading just a couple of days ago, and I don't want to indict Pitchfork here because it might have been Stereo Gum or, you know, Brooklyn Vegan or, you know, it's one of the big music blogs. And, you know, they were talking about one of the North African metal bands that just put out a record. I can't even remember which one, but the lead in the review was, you know, most people still think of heavy metal as a white guy's club, and you know, it's American music for, you know, white suburban teens and whatnot. And you know, that reminds me of when, even now in 2010, you still see articles about comic books saying, hey, comic books have all grown up, you know, now there are comic books for adults, you know, like they're not writing an article that has been relevant for the last, you know, 30 years. Yeah, I mean, even American heavy metal band isn't just for white people anymore, you know, there are tons and tons of Latinos and blacks in contemporary American metal, and there is not a country in the world that doesn't have its own metal scene now.
Exactly. This morning on MSN, I put up a post about four metal bands from Botswana.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are documentaries about the metal scene in Sri Lanka and mm-hmm. you know, and in Colombia, and in, I mean, you know, it's endemic to every culture in the 21st century, and yet, you know, we still have critics going, gasp, you know, there are foreign countries where people like heavy metal that are not completely populated by white people.
There are actually three compilations of metal from Colombia. There's two volumes of From Colombia with Hate, and then there's another one called The Eruption from the South or something like that. And it's all, and that one is more narrowly focused. It's all brutal death metal, so they all sound like they could be from anywhere because they're all doing that My Toilet is Broken sound as mm-hmm. the vocals, you know. But the thing is, like, there's three compilations from Colombia, and they have almost no overlap. There's, like, one band in common between all three of them. You know, and but yeah, the story about metal, you know, not being just for white folks is sort of like there are still people who are shocked that white kids buy lots of rap records.
Yeah. Yeah, probably there's still some people out there writing articles about how you can't dance to jazz anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, don't take away my precious illusion. It's all I have.
All right, well, on that note, are you ready to have a dialogue?
Sure.
All right, let's do it.
Tomcat Jepson changed the way that people thought about Jazz Kazoo. There's just no doubt about that.
I remember we was at the Woodhull Lounge up in Syracuse. It wasn't a big jazz town at the time, and the Woodhull was about the only place in town you could really wail. I was there with Jody and Yank and Big Bill Murphy. And we was just shooting the breeze, having a few drinks, waiting for Monroe, who was the headliner that night, when suddenly this short, skinny dude, who's got up on stage without none of us even starts to take notice, draws a harp up to his mouth. At least we thought it was a harp, but man, what come out don't sound like no harp I ever heard.
Of course, before Tomcat Jepson, nobody thought about Jazz Kazoo at all. It wasn't considered a true jazz instrument. It still isn't, really.
At the height of his career, when we were playing at Tomcat at Blue Note in D.C., we had some reporter from the San Francisco paper come snooping around looking for the next big thing. And at the time, we thought that was Tomcat Jepson. So he asked us to say what it is about the notes he blew that was so special. And Hilton Fontaine, who was our clarinetist at the time, he said, man, you gotta stop listening to the shrill, buzzing, annoying notes he plays. You gotta start listening to the shrill, buzzing, annoying notes he doesn't play. I never forgot that. That's how come I can tell it to you right now.
People like to say he was the greatest jazz kazooist of all time. Other people like to say he was the only jazz kazooist of all time. A few people like to say he's the worst jazz kazooist of all time. Who can say who's right? Maybe all of them. Maybe none of them.
He was really tearing it up, brother, I tell you that. There was such passion, such intensity, such fire in his playing. It sounded like the way an angel would play, or maybe the devil. There'd be times when you just get so caught up in the moment, so overwhelmed and just blown away by the performance. I mean, sometimes it'd be 3 or 4 seconds before you'd say to yourself, wait a minute, that motherfucker is playing a goddamn kazoo! And then you'd walk the hell out, but those 3 or 4 seconds, they were something else.
The kazoo has always borne a curiously muddled reputation. Half musical instrument, half vocal technique, half that trick you do where you put a piece of paper in front of a comb. There are some schools of thought that say it's the most underrepresented instrument in the jazz idiom since the jew's harp, while most contemporary critics argue that you can't get anything out of the kazoo you can't get out of a vocalist with throat cancer humming. But everyone agrees that Tomcat Jepsen is the beginning and end of the conversation about Jazz Kazoo. Hopefully.
You have to understand that in the late 50s, we were touring constantly and cash was just rolling in. Which is how so many of us picked up the habit. Not Tomcat, though. He never touched the stuff. Mostly because he couldn't afford it. He couldn't have traded his axe for 2 feet of rubber tube.
Bird, Miles, Diz, Train, Monk. I think it's safe to say that all of these giants of jazz were completely unaware of Tomcat Jepsen's existence. He didn't play with every single one of them. He never met them or interacted with them in any way. He was aware of them, though. He covered all their material on that golden kazoo. It was a pretty one-sided relationship.
It wasn't literally golden, of course. It wasn't even painted gold. It was red and silver. I don't know what it was made of. Tin, I guess.
What is a kazoo when all is said and done? It's just a cheap instrument you can get for a quarter at a toy store. It's a little metal tube with a membrane on the side that makes a really irritating buzzing sound when you hum or talk through a hole into it. But when Tomcat Jepsen would play it, it became, well, it was still a kazoo. But it kept him out of trouble, and that's something.
Hearken, she who is called Sue. Conan has no need of your foolish tonics and potions. Is this the way of civilization? Are all the men here so weak and womanly that they must anoint their steel with herbs and magics in order to please their womenfolk? Bah! A pox on the degenerate habits of your kind. Conan is a warrior of Cimmeria, not some perfumed fop of Aquilonia. 1,000 harlots and trulls have fallen before Conan's manhood, and all have been satisfied without the use of any of your Cialis. Begone from the inbox of Conan, foolish woman, and peddle your quackery elsewhere, lest I teach you a final lesson. Yours, Conan T. Barbarian. Look ye, who is named Ratio Q Respiration. Since Conan left his homelands in the north, he has always heeded the words ingrained upon him on countless fields of battle. What is good? To crush your enemies, to see them driven before you, to hear the lamentation of their women. Nowhere have I heard it said that what is good is discounted software. By Crom, I am a warrior. Life for me is the clanging of steel, the spilling of blood, the heat and rush of combat. Valor and courage are my strengths. What cares Conan for Photoshop, Microsoft Office, and FileMaker Pro at well below retail costs? If Conan has need for such magical trickery, he will take it, or download it from the Pirate Bay. Call to me no more, Ratio Q Respiration, or I shall split you like a Pictish dog. Yours, Conan T. Barbarian. Greetings, he who is hailed as Dr. Maseke Bronson. At first, Conan was intrigued by your letter. While Conan has nothing but scorn for a man who once possessed his throne and then lost it, for what is a fallen king? He is no better than the lowliest slave. Your offer of gold held my ear. Aye, the gold of a toppled monarch spends just as well as the gold of a reigning pretender. The purse of Conan makes no distinction between one and the other. But rather than offering to buy my sword and thews, so as to slaughter those who deposed you and bring you the heads of all who stand in your way, you rather wish me to engage in the creation and transfer of a number of bank accounts, whatever those are. What civilized trickery is this? Conan is a warrior, a slayer of fools, and a shedder of blood, not a fully licensed and bonded financial representative. Grovel in the dust elsewhere, disgraced one. Do not contact me again or feel the wrath of Conan's junk filter. Yours, Conan T. Barbarian. On your guard, O wizard Thulsa Doom. How did you get my address? Stop bothering me. Seriously. Yours, Conan T. Barbarian.
Well, that just about does it for this week's excursion into the unlikable. We hope you've enjoyed the latest Batodcast and that when we're gone, you won't make jokes about the curious odor. Thanks to Phil Freeman for joining us this week. His work can be found at burningambulance.com, runningthevoodoodown.blogspot.com, at MSN's Headbang blog, and elsewhere on the web. You can buy his books through any number of trustworthy online text mongers. As always, the Batodcast theme song is by Hayden Childs of North Kakalaka, and the tomato is our official fruit/vegetable. If you'd like to appear on this show, please write to guests@ludiclive.com, and info@ludiclive.com is the place to write for hate mail of a more general nature. The Batodcast may be had at any time on ludiclive.com, or as a free subscription and or download from the iTunes Music Store. This episode is dedicated to Bruce Dickinson and Sir Nigel Weatherby, and most of all, to you. Please join us again in 2 weeks for another special celebrity guest. Jokes that will seem less funny in retrospect, and more speech impediments than you would think possible coming from a single person. Reminding you that if you hate everything, you love us. This is your Batodcast.